City Center for Science Outreach, and I want to thank you for downloading this episode of Snacks for the Brain. We're truly grateful for your interest in what we're doing to bring the joy of research and discovery to K-12 students and teachers the whole world over. If you're not in either of these categories, maybe you're just an interesting person who's interested in the world. In any case, welcome. Bi-weekly or so, we'll share some fun, independent, pod-safe music. We'll interview some working research scientists, students, or leading proponents of educational change. And we'll toss in an educational sound-seeing tour or computer tip.
That's it for you. We'll be right here.
At blogs.vanderbilt.edu/S4TheB and at the CSO website at scienceoutreach.org, sharing good brain munchies with you. So listen up, let's get right down to it with episode number
77
of Snacks for the Brain. Hey there, listeners. Welcome to this episode of Snacks for the Brain. I have some audio from the School for Science and Math at Vanderbilt, and it's a question and answer portion from last week's wonderful visit by Nobel laureate Dr. Stanley Cohen. Working with Rita Levi-Montalcini, co-recipient of the Nobel Prize in 1986, at Washington University in St. Louis in the 1950s, Cohen isolated nerve growth factor and then went on to discover epidermal growth factor. He continued his research on cellular growth factors after moving to Vanderbilt University in 1959. His research on cellular growth factors has proven fundamental to understanding the development of cancer and designing anti-cancer drugs. That from Wikipedia. The School for Science and Math is, of course, the fantastic program offered out of the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, which brings 25 students from each grade level of high school from Metro Nashville Public Schools to the Vanderbilt campus one day a week during the academic school year. I would love to include the entire hour, but that would be more main course than snack. And true to the spirit of Snacks for the Brain, we'll stick to the tasty morsel Dr. Cohen shared at the end of his visit, the question and answer. You'll hear the voices of the Professor Emeritus in Biochemistry and those of the students and teachers of the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach's School for Science and Math at Vanderbilt. The story that Dr. Cohen shares out about investigating the similarity between the enzymes in earthworms and in human livers, and how he watered the lawn all afternoon and come nighttime put a miner's cap on his head and crawled around on the ground and collected thousands of worms to study, is enough reward in itself. I also love the attribution of his recognition as one-third hard work, one-third luck, and one-third knowing what to do because we're not smart enough to know what we don't know. Very cool. The interchanges are enlightening all around, and I'm sure that you will thoroughly enjoy the listen. Before we get going, I'll pump up the volume on what you've been hearing underneath this little rant. Grand Prize, music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com from Amb26, a very popular ambient artist named Anthony Barnes from the UK. After Cohen's spot, I'll play you out with another prize-themed song from music.podshow.com, Ottawa, Canada's Doug Hempstead's The Prize. And don't leave after that, because in my search for songs about prizes, this is, after all, a Nobel Prize podcast, I found a lovely mellow song from another Canadian, Hilary Grist. You'll like it. Bear in mind, if you will, that when you hear Dr. Cohen begin to talk, he's already spent a half hour describing in intricate detail the foundations of his life's work. The questions ensue. Cheers, and happy holidays, everybody. Snacks for the Brain. Thank you.
since then, everybody with mitochondrial tubule factors started looking for this. And sure enough, insulin has its own receptor and has its own tyrosine kinase. And other growth factors do that. So now there are hundreds of growth factors like that. And they're present in people, they're present in the worms, they're present in insects. EGF-like molecules and kinases like this. And the big question is, how does the cell now know which kinase is hitting it at being activated, and how does it do the many things to make a cell grow?
Can I ask a question? Sorry. So when you were originally doing this work, did you and other people that were working on similar problems realize how revolutionary it was? How revolutionary it was. Did you realize the real importance of it?
No, we're just curious, we're interested. It was a phenomenon. I didn't have to... I know statistics are important, but I hate statistics. Those guys that like statistics, I know they're very important. But this is all or nothing. It either worked or didn't work. It didn't have to use statistics. It was something that made cells grow. In an animal, it made eyes open up because the cells grew. And it made cells grow because there was a receptor that bounded on the membrane and put the signal inside the cell to activate the enzyme. That enzyme then did many other things to make go into the nucleus and make proteins, or go into channels and make ion channels, or go into the cytoskeleton and do things. So many, many, many signals. So now the problem is, how does the cell know the difference between one tyrosine kinase and one another?
Dr. Cohen, from the time you started your work with mice and opening their eyes to this point in which you're talking about pathways and receptors, how much time is involved?
40 years.
Okay. Lifetime of work.
And how many different places were you at over that time?
Oh, I was at Washington University for the nerve growth business, right? And then the eye-opening, I came to Vanderbilt and decided I was going to do something different. I was going to look at eye-opening. And I came to Vanderbilt in 1959. That's over 50 years ago. And I retired about 10 years ago. So, I'll just tell you, it was great fun. I was interested in it. It was fun. Science was fun for me. It was interesting and fun. And they paid me.
When you were in high school or middle school, did you know you wanted to be a scientist when you grew up?
I knew I wanted to do something that had some, but I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do something that might have some lasting significance, right? I just didn't want to do something that didn't last, didn't make, I did my job fine and it was over. But I wanted to do something that made something happen, change, make something different. Can you understand that? I just didn't want to just do a job and go home and that's it. So, keep asking. The only thing I say about advice is do what you're interested in doing, and then you'll do it very well. And if you luck out, you'll get paid for it. But do what you're interested in. If you're doing what you're interested in, no matter what, you'll do it well. If you're not interested in it, so it could be science, music, or anything else. But you do what you're interested in. So they got the Nobel Prize for discovering the nerve growth factor and the epidermal growth factor. And of course, there weren't any factors known before that. And the difference between a growth factor and a hormone, you heard the insulin and growth factor. Hormones are defined, they're made in a specific place, like the insulin in the beta cell or pancreas or growth hormone or pituitary, and then affect many other cells. Okay, that's hormone. Growth factors can be made in many different cells. They can be made in all cells. So you can discover the old hormones by cutting out the thyroid and you found out that it made thyroxine, right? Or pituitary, and it's growth hormone. But you can't cut out the whole brain or the liver and decide, because you're dead. So you can only cut out an organ that you can remove and the animal lives. That's how the classical hormones were discovered. So if these were growth factors were discovered, because you see phenomenon, just trying to understand phenomena. So it's lots of luck. And you know what, you have to know what you're doing, so it's luck and interest and all mixed up together. And so now there are hundreds of growth factors, you know. And the nerve growth and epidermal growth factor were the first two that were discovered. Then everybody started looking for them, of course. You look for them, then you find them. If you don't look, you don't find them. Okay, so I think any other questions of what I did and why I did it?
What would you say about the technology that you had at that time, how easy or hard it was for you?
We didn't have molecular biology, so you guys working and trying to do something like now, I was smart enough to know, I knew had no biology what I was looking at, and no ordinary chemistry. Now, DNA, RNA revolutions, now you don't have no molecular biology and technology there, so you have to know three fields instead of two. And you sort of make advances if you know more fields, and then you can apply one field to another field. Then you discover new things.
Are you impressed at how far science has gone?
I thought it was incredible. I shouldn't say that. Okay. Besides satisfying my curiosity and understanding, this research and many useful things. For example, you know, cancers. Cells grow like mad, and all you can do is bash them and kill rapidly growing cells. Then you also lose your hair and you think bad things. So that's what you try to treat. If you knew exactly why each cancer, they're all different, why each cancer did its thing, you could make a specific thing to cure it. So for example, for certain breast cancers, not all, but certain breast cancers and certain colon cancers in people who were discovered they were cancerous because they made too many of these receptors, and they had mutated receptors, right? So the so-called magic bullet, and this works, if there are too many of these things, you could slow it down and have remission in those patients who unfortunately have cancer, but fortunately have one that you know what's wrong with it. You can put in an antibody to the receptor or a little molecule that stops the kinase. That's Gleevec or Herceptin antibody that's made now. Right? So those are specific, quote, magic bullets for specific cancers. Right? So the trick, in my mind, is now each cancer is mutated and grows wildly for different reasons. So you have to know what each cancer specifically does. Then you have a chance of hitting it rather than blasting it with something that kills all rapidly growing cells. So this kind of treatment sort of slows it down until it mutates and then not effective. So no real cure, but it certainly is at least as effective as anything else. It slows things down. So I certainly didn't expect to discover growth factors or the cures for some cancers. But if you don't know how things work, you can't fix them.
Do you know of anything else that your research is being used for recently?
Pardon?
Do you know of anything else that your research
is being used for? No, all I know is as far as clinical use, is the discovery that certain cancers have excess of these receptors, and you can block it by making an antibody or block it by using a small molecule that slows the enzyme that's stimulating. I know of. There may be others that somebody's looking at. There are other things, ancillary, not directly, but ancillary. For example, certain autoimmune diseases are caused by too much stimulation of some of your white cells. And some of the things, the mechanism of white cells doing things, are caused by activating similar tyrosine kinase, not EGF, but other tyrosine kinases in the cell. So sometimes you can block some autoimmune diseases by putting inhibitors into this enzyme. Of course, you slow down the white cells and make antibodies that do you harm. Right? So who knows what's going to happen next year?
What is your favorite thing about science?
What's my favorite thing? It's fun and interesting. It keeps me thinking. Right? It's just fun and interesting. Okay? And everybody has their own interests. Some people are totally uninterested. And some people are very interested. So that's why I think, do what you're interested in. And I was interested in science. How do things work? Taking things apart and seeing how they work. That was what I was interested in. Because it's all mysterious. And I don't like mysteries. I want to understand as best I could why things happen. And some things I have no idea why they happen, of course.
While you were here, did you continue to collaborate with Dr. Bartolcini, or did you just, were both aware of what each other was doing?
Oh yeah, well we worked together, and man, I'm getting up there, and she's got 10 years on me, so we don't do any more research, we quit. No, but we collaborate. She went on continuing her nerve growth studies, and I changed fields and went to this epidermal growth factor. So those are the two new growth factors that were discovered, the first ones. And now there are hundreds of thousands of them.
What did your parents think of all of this?
Unfortunately, my parents passed away at an early age when I was just starting. So they knew I was in a laboratory, but they didn't know that I got famous. Right? I just knew I had a job. They were happy I had a job and earned a living. They didn't have support. So they didn't know about it because I got famous. They had died.
Do you think that like other people would have discovered the same factors that you did, and it was like a race?
Okay. I think eventually somebody, I'm not unique, eventually somebody else would have seen it. You don't know how long, 1 year, 10 years, 50 years, eventually somebody would be interested in it, discovered. That's what I think. I don't know that, of course. But I think eventually somebody would have noticed something like that. But there are lots of accidents, and the question is, how often do accidents happen? They take a long time. So it's all coming about by people doing experiments, making observations, and trying to figure out what they were doing to cause something that looked weird, you know, or made rooms grow, or made eyes open up.
Dr. Cohen, could you give us a little insight on how you transitioned from the research that you did as a graduate student at Michigan and then to your postdoc at WashU? How does a graduate student come up with an idea to work on?
Oh, boy. Yeah, let's see. when I went to Oberlin, so mostly in zoology, I got a master's in zoology, and they told me that earthworms, biology, you know, all kinds of critters, earthworms have ordinary fishing worms, have sort of yellow cells around their guts, and they told me that those yellow cells did the same thing as human liver. Right. So I'll try to, just a minute, while I reconstruct the events of 50 years ago. So, I was at Michigan when I was going for my PhD. I thought that it was in the biochem department, and who's a very good professor there. He says, well, you think of something you want to do and see if you can do it here. So I said, I wonder whether these yellow cells around the gut of the worm, whether the enzymes in those cells are really like our human liver. They're the same enzymes that make urea and stuff in us, our nitrogen metabolism. They're the same enzymes in the worm as our liver. Right? So what I did was, I want to know, is it the same enzymes? So what I did, as in the campus of the University of Michigan, there's lots of grass, it's like Nashville, and there are lots of earthworms around. Right? So to get earthworms, I watered the lawn all afternoon. You know, after rain, the worms come up. Right? So the worms come up, and then and come nighttime, I put a miner's lamp on my head and crawled around on the ground and collected thousands of earthworms to study. Right? And kept them in the cold room in a pile of dirt. And ground up the intestines and looked at the enzymes, and sure enough, it was just like the liver. It had exactly the same mechanism, the same kind of thing to make urea that people did. I thought that was interesting. Some people think it's crazy to study worms, but that's what I was interested in is, do we, are our enzymes the same as the enzymes in a worm? And the answer is yes.
When you were doing your research, did you ever think that you could get a prize for finding something?
No. No, I was happy doing what I was doing, and it was paying me.
How has getting the Nobel Prize changed your life with people around you?
I'm getting invited to talk to kids like you. So it's fun. Of course, it changed. I tried it. It hasn't really changed it. I mean, it has changed it. Of course, it's going to Sweden to get the Nobel Prize. 10 days, they treat you like a king. You can't do anything. You move around and find it. You gain weight because they don't let you move. They carry you from place to place. But 10 days being a king is enough. Now you just want to be a normal person. Yeah. So I tried it. Influence me as little as possible.
How many years after the discovery were you awarded the prize?
I was awarded the prize in 1986.
And the discovery was made?
Oh, the first, the original discoveries were made 40 years ago. And then maybe 20 years ago, 40 years ago for Nuremberg Factor, 20 years ago for Epidermal Growth Factor, 20 years ago. I knew it was important, but I had no idea they were going to call me up and say, hey, you just won the Nobel Prize.
Did you believe them when they called you?
Pardon?
Did you believe them when they called you?
Well, it was a phone in the middle of the night, and there were a couple of scientists who were named Stanley Cohen. There's several that I know personally. So I didn't believe the first one. I said, which, and they're good scientists. I said, which Stanley Cohen? Usually phones in the middle of the night mean disaster, but this is a reporter calling from Sweden.
So it was actually a reporter that told you and not the Nobel Committee?
Yeah, it was a reporter that called me up in the middle of the night.
So can you tell us a little more about what the experience is like getting the prize when you go to Stockholm and what
they
do?
They They drive you around, you don't do anything. Everything is programmed minute to minute. You know, and they dress you up in a tuxedo, they measure you and give you a tuxedo and take you one dinner to another dinner to another dinner. And they give you little talks, and that's about it.
Do they send someone to your hotel room to sing to you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and they warn you. They warn you. Because in the middle of the night, they have maybe 10, 12-year-old, you guys, 12, 13-year-old girls come in white dresses and little hats and start singing to you. And they warn you because they did that to a previous Nobel Prize winner, and he didn't know about it, and he thought he was in heaven and had heart attack. All you know is you say you're singing, and you look up, and you see these 12 angels. So I can see where that could start with you. They don't know about that. They were dressed up as angels.
So given your experience in science and with the Nobel Prize, what area in science, or maybe relative to your field, do you see as the next Nobel Prize?
Oh, that is the inside web. One, what are all the connections inside the cell? How does the cell know what to do with these signals? How does it, what is the mechanism? And the next one, of course, is your brain. How do we think? How do we remember anything? As far as I know, nobody has the foggiest notion. So somebody has to accidentally have a good thought. How do we think? How do we record memories?
Big question.
So how much of your success do you put down to luck? Or, I mean, you asked at the beginning.
I'd say one third is luck, one third is just hard work, and one third is knowing what to do. Knowing how to do things. I would say one third, one third, one third. Yeah, absolutely. But without each of them, everything's hard, but you need the luck. Because we're not smart enough, at least I know you're smart enough, to know what you don't know, necessarily. So you need luck. But you need to know what you're doing, and you have to work. So you can do something about working, and you can do something about studying, and you can hope for luck. But you need it, I think. So far as I know, all brand new things, a good chunk of it comes from luck. Of course, when they're really brand new, you don't think about it. Some accident happens, and you see something.
Dr. Cohen, we'd like to thank you so much for coming today. And so we have our three class representatives here that would like to say a few words.
Dr. Cohen, on behalf of the class, we would like to thank you for coming today and speaking to us and for taking your time to help be a scientist, be more intellectual.
And so we have some gifts to award you. We have a grocery bag that's reusable.
We have
candy,
chocolate
offset,
carbon. And we have a Vanderbilt School of Math and Science
to keep you warm in this cold weather.
Cold Tennessee weather. It's nothing compared to Michigan weather, but still, it's cold.
It also gets cold, but I like the sun. And I thank you all for coming and listening. I hope you have fun listening to me.
Really,
it was really a pleasure. session.
Then I'd love to talk to people who are interested in it. Remember it and do something about it, that'd be great. So thank you very, very much.
Snacks for the Brain is brought to you by the fine folks at the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out the website at scienceoutreach.org.
Alone in my room, I can hear the traffic on the distance. Soon the pale moon. don't have